No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to us at BBSRADIO and the number 1. Maria, unfortunately, is not with us tonight. As you might know, we discussed this last week briefly. Her father passed away, and there's a memorial service, and she's there. And our condolences go out to her and her family. And we know we'll see her again next week. But we do have a special treat tonight. We have J. Lewis Mills, who's an actor and activist and outspoken advocate for many causes, and he's on the show tonight. And we're glad to have him. So we're gonna bypass my little report on what's going on with statehood, because nothing really happened this week in Washington. Let's just bring J. Lewis on and start the conversation. J. Lewis, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you very kindly. I am very honored to be on your show, Senator Brown. How are you doing?
Good. And we're honored to have you, because we generally don't have people like you that have your experience and are in your line of work. You know, we're all enthralled by actors. I remember when we had the national convention in Los Angeles, and I was out there, and it was funny to see all the politicians kind of pushed aside by the actors, because everybody wanted to see the actors, and it was real, you know, it was funny to watch these guys that have very big egos walk into a room and just be, nobody cared about them. In Washington, they're the bomb, but nobody cared about them because there were actors that came, and they're like, oh my God, look at so-and-so or so-and-so. And so everyone went over to get autographs and stuff. But you know, that's what our society is. And we do think what you do is really, really cool. So how did you start doing this? Is this something you've been doing your whole life? I know you were on a hit show called Heartbeat. But other than, and you've had movie credits and other things, tell us about your career.
Well, you know, this isn't really something that I take that back. I did when I was younger, I did want to become an actor, you know, but with some poor decisions that I made in my younger years, you know, it didn't seem as though this was going to be, you know, a journey that I was going to be able to fulfill. But I did start out, doing background extra work in Phoenix, Arizona. There were a lot of television movies or films, excuse me, that came to Phoenix in order to shoot. And the first film that I was a background extra in was Waiting to Exhale. And I guess you can say that's where I really caught the bug, because that was the first set that I was on. And I just loved the whole process of it. And, you know, I did some other background work. But in 2010, I was working a job in Phoenix, Arizona, excuse me, and I was actually on the bus. And it just came over me. I cannot sit in that cubicle and talk on the phone again. So I got off the bus. I crossed the street, got back on the bus, taking me back home. I went, went home, and I got on Craigslist, and I found a job in Sunland, California, being a caretaker for an Alzheimer's couple. And so in July of 2010, I moved to Sunland. And unfortunately, in April of 2011, they passed away. One passed away, and then the other passed away a few weeks later. Wow. And, you know, I had mentioned, you know, when I was doing my background work, I had, you know, a few of my friends knew that I was doing that. And I always have people tell me, you know, that business is too hard to get in. You can't get in it. It's something you can't do. The only person that ever told me that I could, you know, do what I wanted to do was my grandmother. So when the couple that I was caretaking for, when they passed away, I didn't want to go back to Phoenix because, I mean, I had just left Phoenix because I thought it was a dead end place for me. So I was just like, you know, what am I going to do now? So I was like, you know, I'm in Los Angeles. Let me try my hand at acting. And I went on Craigslist again, and there was a movie that was looking for actors. And the name of the movie is Weirdo's Robbery. You can go on YouTube now and see it. It was a crazy movie. The cool thing for me about this film is the whole film is nothing but improv. You know, the director would tell us, the director told us what he wanted, you know, how long the scene was going to be and, you know, what he wanted. But it was up to us actors to come up with the dialogue. So if anyone does go to YouTube and watch Weirdo's Robbery, just understand everything you see me do and everything you hear me say, I came up with like right then and there. So for me, that was a cool job to have because it really tested, you know, my creativity. And from that job, I remember I was on Facebook and I put a message up that I was looking for an acting school to join. And someone told me, one of the people that was in this film with me responded, gave me the name of an acting studio in West Hollywood. That I joined that studio, I don't know, sometime in 2011. And then in the end of 2013, a pretty negative situation happened between me and this studio. So I left and I went somewhere else. And I went to a workshop. It was a Q&A, supposed to be a Q&A workshop. It was an agent, a casting director, a producer, and I forget what the fourth person was. And the first part of the workshop was supposed to be us actors doing an exercise. We were going to take a break, and we were going to go into the second part of the workshop, which was us actors being able to ask the panel of people questions. They told us what they did, and we would be able to ask them questions. Well, the agent that was going to be on that panel, she left her office earlier than usual because she wanted to try and beat traffic and make sure she got there on time. So she got there right as I was getting up doing, you know, my part of the exercise. And then, you know, we took a break and we came back and, you know, we did the whole question thing. And I asked her questions. I said, I have a 3-part question. And she said, okay. And I said, do I have a look that you can market? Does your agency represent anybody that looks like me? And can you and I make money together? And she said, no, no, and yes. And I said, okay, I have one more question. When can I schedule a meeting with you to sit down and figure out what I have to do to hold up my end of our business relationship. And she said, I'll talk to you after we're done. Now, she wasn't coming there to sign anybody. She was just coming there in order to be a part of this panel. So, but because of my performance and because of the questions that I asked her, it was the end of the year, 2013. It was just about time for Thanksgiving. And she told me to contact her at the beginning of 2014 when they would be back in their office. And that date came for me to contact her. And I didn't want to contact her on that day because that was the first day she was coming back. So I didn't want to get lost in, because I knew she had emails and all that. So I waited an extra couple of days, and then I contacted her, and we had a conversation, and she had me do some things that I had to do. You know, I had to put up some my picture and headshot and resume and all that on a couple of the casting sites. And then, you know, she started representing me. That was January of 2014. And after she started representing me, I did some short films and some music videos. And then in March of 2015, I went to an audition for the show Heartbeat. I got invited to a callback right after the audition. So I went to the callback the next day. And then I got invited to the screen test the next day after that. And by that next Thursday, I was on the plane heading to Vancouver, British Columbia, in order to shoot the pilot, because they ended up giving me a series regular role playing the perfusionist on the show. It was a medical drama. So,
well, what is a perfusionist?
Perfusionist is the person that, if you have to go in for any type of surgical procedure and your heart is stopped, you are hooked up to what's called a heart-lung bypass machine. And the perfusionist operates that machine, as well as throughout the surgery, there are different medications that the perfusionist will administer throughout the surgery. So I got the role playing that, and you know, that was basically the opportunity that opened the door for me, and now it's just up to me to keep that door open.
Wow, what a story, you know. And it's so interesting to me to hear stories like this, because I think that, you know, we all, as we travel through life, we all have a combination of things that happen to us that involve a little luck and a little determination and, yes, and, you know, the way we move. And it's interesting to see how it all comes together for people. And since you mentioned your grandmother, let me just say that I had a I think grandmothers are visionaries, that they get to, they see in us things that we can't see in ourselves, and that other people very often can't see. So
yes,
one good grandmother is worth her weight in gold.
Absolutely.
And I had one that was tough and determined and but she saw in us only the best, in all of us, saw only the best. So she was an inspiration to us all. So now you've become an actor. And I mean, an established actor. And what's in store for you? Is there anything new on the horizon for you in acting?
Well, currently, right now, you know, I'm back at it. I am, I'm auditioning now. I just had a really cool audition yesterday that I'm feeling kind of good about. But you know, to me, it's all a part of the process. And I'm one of those actors that, yes, I do, you know, want to get back at it. Yes, I do want to work, but you know, I want to work in and for, you know, the right situation. I don't want to work just to work. I'm doing this, and the number one thing that actually drives my passion for acting is just being able to tell a story in the most realistic, natural, most present way. And in order to do that, I feel I really have to believe in the story that I'm telling. So, you know, I don't just want to have any job. I'm really looking at, you know, what's the best story to tell. So, you know, I'm in that process now, and you know, I feel grateful to just, you know, I'm doing what I love. I'm doing absolutely what I love. I just started writing again as well. And, you know, hosting my own show. So, you know, I try to keep right now until I do find my next, you know, good substance type job. I'm just trying my best to keep my creativity alive and just other different projects that I'm trying to work on right now.
Well, you know, that must be a very hard thing to do. You know, there are a lot of people in the world that have a hard time being self-motivated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've certainly gone through bouts where, you know, you get out of bed in the morning and you really don't have any particular thing to do, and you find yourself wasting time. So it's hard. That's a hard thing to do. And I'm glad that you're on that path. Politicians and actors, I think, have a lot in common.
Yes.
One of the things they have in common is they put themselves out there, and they have to be ready for rejection. You know, there's when you run for election, you win sometimes and you lose sometimes. And I'm sure that's the same with actors. And when you look for the roles that you want to play, what exactly are you looking for? You're looking for the story that you want to tell. Is that right? Not necessarily something that advances your career as much as adds to who you are as an actor?
Yes. Well, I mean, yes and no, but more yes. When I look at, if I'm looking at a character, if I have the opportunity for an audition, I look at the story, I look at the character, I look at the character's involvement, and I kind of try and look at the big picture. How realistic is this? You know, I try to envision myself in the role. How am I going to look in this role? Now, I mean, if it's a role where I have to act like a buck nutty idiot, you know, if it tells the story and it's part of the story, I have no problem with committing to that degree. I can commit to a character. It just, my number one question is, how relevant is this? How relevant is this story? So, I don't really do too much of like the slapstick type silly comedy. I'm not saying that there's not a place for that in the world, but as far as me wanting to be a storyteller, that's not necessarily, in my opinion, telling a story. That's that type of work is a project, you know, that's done for entertainment, for you to have fun with.
Right.
Well, my fun comes in telling a real story. My fun comes in, you know, telling a real dramatic story. So I do kind of lean more towards the drama or the suspense or the thriller type. But at the end of the day, for me, the most important is the story, the relevance of the character, and the relevance of telling the story at this time in our lives and in our society.
Well, you know, I think that's absolutely right, that there's a place for both of those things. Sometimes you just want to be entertained, you know, and you just want to go and you want to laugh and you want to see Jim Carrey and you want to see him do something stupid. And, you know, and sometimes I just recently, my wife and I watched a movie, Hidden Figures, and you know, you want it. What a great story, right? You want to hear that story, and then you're amazed. You're amazed that these women who were so brilliant, but but were, you know, ignored and abused, but they, you know, they triumphed anyway in the end. And that really is always a great story, right? The triumph of the human spirit. So there's a place for both of them. And, you know, given your background and your experience, I think you personally feel like you bring a lot to the table. And I know that at one time you were homeless. And can we talk about that for a minute or for a few minutes? Because, first of all, I don't think that most people realize that homelessness is something that happens to all different sorts of people. Successful people, unsuccessful people, people that have mental problems, people that are perfectly normal. As I told you when we talked earlier, I worked in a soup kitchen for 10 years. So I met a lot of homeless people, and they really cover the entire spectrum. So how did it happen that you became homeless?
Well, when I it was February of 2013, I went to have my I had a cataract in my eye, and I went in actually October of 2012 to have it taken out, and the doctor actually dropped it. And my eye is longer than the tool that is used to take a cataract out of a person's eye. So they had to wait for the cataract to surface because the instrument wasn't long enough to go into the back of my eye and get it. So this happened more than once. And just to keep the energy of negativity away from the story, I won't lay blame. I won't, you know, I won't any of that. But I had more than one surgery on my eye, and my eye couldn't take it. So something happened, and I lost vision in my eye. So after that, you know, March, April, May of 2013, you know, it was hard for me to find a regular job in order to sustain, you know, a place to live and bills and all that. When I would go into a place, you know, because I was wearing an eye patch, people would say, you know, I was an insurance claim walking, or you know, I would be given reasons why, well, you know, you can't see this small print, and, you know, we can't make all of our documents bigger just for you. You know, so I was given reasons. So it was hard for me to find employment. While I was recuperating, I wasn't really doing anything as far as film is concerned, because I'm worrying about my eye. Right. So I did, you know, have to take a break from that. But, you know, then once I realized, you know, I'm just not going to find a job, you know, that's when I did, you know, start looking at Craigslist again, or trying to find acting jobs. Before my agent, I had like almost zero contacts to the acting world. So like the LA castings of the world, the Actors Accesses of the world, I didn't know anything about any of those. So I'm just trying to book stuff off of Craigslist, which anyone that works in my industry, especially today, knows, you know, you're really not going to book anything off of right. Craigslist. I did not want to go back to Phoenix, because as I said earlier, that was such a dead-end situation. And because so many people had told me it was something I couldn't do, you know, I just had to make the decision. The last day I was in the place that I was living, it's like, you know, this is it. You know, I have to go through this in order to, I have to go through this in order to get out of this, if that makes sense. I have to be without, and I have to start with nothing in order to build what I'm going to build. I couldn't go and, well, I didn't, I, it's not that I couldn't do this because it was just my pride, but I didn't have a friend that was offering me a place to live. I didn't have a family member that was offering me a place to live. I was basically fending for myself. You started out, you know, I would stay in emergency rooms of hospitals. I stayed at LAX airport so much, and you know, I have a pretty unique look, which I, at the beginning of all this, I didn't really understand how unique and how much I stood out wearing an eye patch and cutting my facial hair the way that I do and just having the look that I do. But I was staying up at the LAX airport so much that those police up there, they started recognizing me being there like every day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they told me that I wasn't going to be able to come back. And it was just kind of funny because when I was on my way out of town going to Vancouver, one of the officers that told me I couldn't stay up there anymore ran into me. And he's like, you know, I really don't want to arrest you. You've got to go. And I put my bag down. I showed him my contract. I showed him my ticket. And I said, I got a job, man. I'm going to Vancouver. I'm not trying to stay in your airport now. And he shook my hand and he was like, you know, you are an inspiration. I'm going to tell everybody about you. So, you know, that was cool for me. But, you know, getting back to being homeless, you know, I would stay in stay at the airport. I would stay at
What do you mean stay at the airport? I mean, you just spend the whole you slept at the airport and you.
Yeah. Yes. Wow. I would go to the airport at like 9, 10 o'clock at night. Sometimes I would go to the airport at like 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would just sit there. I would charge my phone. I would be on my phone on Craigslist or, you know, trying to find some type of an acting job. And then, like, once it got overtime, when people would have to spend the night for a layover or what have you, I would just find a corner where it was populated with other people that were asleep. I would sleep. Then in the morning, you know, you can hear people getting up. I would get up, get on the train, go to the library in downtown Phoenix and go into one of the bathrooms and wash up, shave, wash up. I would get on the internet, stay there for a while, get on the internet, try and spend my time doing something, trying to. Now, I wasn't just, you know, just hanging out. I'm right. On the internet. I'm trying to find something. I'm trying to, whether it's an acting job or I'm on Craigslist trying to find some other kind of something. You know, I was always looking. Once I got my agent and she started sending me out to auditions and stuff, you know, that's when I was doing the music videos and that's when I was doing the smaller movies. If I had a job, I would carry my suitcase on set and I would just make it seem like I was bringing extra looks for clothes.
Right.
In case you wanted to put me in something else. But if I had an audition, I would stick my suitcase in a bush somewhere near the building. Or I would put it somewhere around the building where I thought it was going to be safe for the 15, 20 minutes that, you know, I was in the audition. But for me, being homeless, it needed to happen because everything that happened after, I think I had just found a place in Pasadena like 3 weeks before I had gotten the audition for Heartbeat, and the audition for Heartbeat was a Wednesday. And I remember that Monday I was on the telephone with a friend of mine. It was the middle of March. I was on the telephone with a friend saying, you know, I don't know how I'm going to pay for my rent in April. So, you know, this may just be a 1 month thing for me. And then 2 days later, you know, here comes Heartbeat. But, you know, during my time of being homeless, you know, it was humbling. When I say it was humiliating, I don't mean it was humiliating. I mean, it just made me a more humble person. Right. Absolutely made me grateful for everything that I have now and every opportunity that I have going forward. But at the same time, it helped me realize that there were three different types of homeless people. There's the homeless person that is down on their luck and this is a temporary thing and they're going to get out of it like I was. There's the mentally incapable person who is either so far gone with their mental illness that they just can't be around people, or they are so far ahead of whatever a mental hospital can do for them that mental hospitals are starting to overcrowd, so they'll just put them out on the street. And then there's the type of homeless person that, you know, kind of gets under my skin a little bit, and that's the one that will, that kind of makes a bad name for the other two types of homeless people. And that's the homeless person that knows and has researched every government subsidy program, or that has researched every loophole, or that knows every angle to cut as far as having, you know, the government pay for them, as far as, you know, they know they can get a check from here, they can get a check from there, they can get an EBT card, which is the food stamp card, and either A, sell that card for more money, or B, just take the money off of that food stamp card and just buy a bunch of junk food. So, you know, there's those three different types of people that are almost all in a melting pot, and everyone is treated the same just because they're homeless. You know, there's
I don't think a lot of people realize that, and you know, we certainly you know, that's something I certainly saw at the soup kitchen too. There mm-hmm. were people that were in your situation. Some of them weren't even homeless. They were living, you know, they had a place to stay. If mm-hmm. they weren't in a shelter, they were with a relative sleeping on the couch or whatever, and they would come to the soup kitchen because they understood they could get a meal there, or they could feed yes. their children. Yes. But there were also people that were regulars that were, mm-hmm. you know, and you saw them at all, you know, that third group that you were talking about.
Yes.
The first group in Washington, we try to deal with them in a thing called rapid rehousing. We try to get to those people that were in your situation, at least theoretically, and put them in a housing situation so that the situation that they have, which is temporary, doesn't become chronic. But it's that yeah. middle group that you talked about that is really, really hard to deal with. You know, and we saw after government programs changed in the 1980s, just tons of people out in the street because they were being turned away from mental hospitals, and they really need care, and they really shouldn't be on the street. So, I mean, that's an important distinction you make, that they have the three different types of homeless. So how long were you homeless?
I was homeless on and off for 18 months. And when I say wow. on and off, you know, I did have a friend I did have a friend that lived in South Los Angeles, and I had another friend that lived in Santa Monica that, you know, maybe once a month I would go and, you know, I would be able to go and wash my clothes, and I would spend time at their place, you know, for like 2 or 3 days. But that only happened like early on. It just got to the point where, you know, I said to myself and to my friends, you know, if I can still come here and wash my clothes, that would be great. But as far as sleeping here, it's almost worse to sleep at someone's place for 2 or 3 right. days for me, because my mind is racing so much, because I'm like, okay, I've got 2 days of a place to stay. I've got to figure something out. So I'm right. completely stressing myself out over those 2 days, where if I'm just on the street, my mind is a lot clearer. And when I was homeless, you know, I would kind of do what I called the homeless person check. You know, if I thought that I was looking kind of ragged, or if I thought I was looking a little too dirty, and I would walk up to somebody And I would say, hi, I'm on my way to an audition and I have to play a homeless guy. Do I look homeless to you? And if they said no, then I knew that I still looked clean. And if they said yes, then I knew it was time for me to change my clothes or shave or whatever it is I needed to do. So, you know, I tried to, a lot of people didn't know when I was homeless, but a lot of people didn't know that I was homeless. But I didn't, number one, I didn't think that was anything that needed to be public news. Because just because someone knows you're homeless doesn't mean that they can or will do something for you. Right. So to me, what's the use of telling someone that you're homeless if, number one, you're probably not going to accept their help because it's going to be something temporary? I didn't want to be comfortable, Senator Brown, until I was in a job in the acting industry that was paying my bills. If I would have gotten a regular job, I didn't want 1 year, 2 years, 3 years to go by with me working at this regular job, paying my bills. And then I say, you know what? I haven't been to an audition in 3 years.
Right.
Because I haven't had the time. So, you know, I knew the sacrifices that I was going to be making. And you know, some people have told me how cocky or conceited I am. You know, that's your opinion, but I always knew that this was going to be an industry I was going to be successful in. The frustration for me was I just didn't know when. So I believed in myself enough to where I was willing to be homeless because I knew at the other side of that mountain was going to be what I was wanting.
Well, and you know what? I don't think it's a matter of being cocky to have faith in yourself. I think you need to do that to succeed a lot of times. And I have a similar experience. It's not anything like yours, but when I started my own business, and I had it for 25 years, and I was pretty successful at it, and it was the same. I had a similar approach in that I had gotten divorced. I got married very early in life and had no children or anything, but got divorced, and I decided to start this business because I said to myself, you know, I have no responsibility now. Now is the time. I'm on my own. If I'm going to fail and fall flat on my face, this is the time to do it. And I did it. And I borrowed $400 from my sister and built a business around it. You know, in the first 3 months or 4 months, I had worked at a place where I was an administrator, and I was able to get credit cards for myself because when they called for job verifications, I was the guy they talked to about me. So I always gave myself a glowing reference, right? Right.
Yeah.
Just like you develop these strategies, right?
Yeah.
So I charged my first 3 or 4 months rent when I started. I think I'm still paying that charge off, you know. Never take a cash advance on your credit card. But, you know, but similarly, I said, you know, now is the time to do it. And I used to think of this. I always remember when I was a kid, my dad telling me that when Caesar went to invade Carthage, when his men got off the boats, he set all the boats on fire. And he said, the only way back to Rome is over the Carthaginians. It was motivation,
yes.
You know, and I can see that you did that. And look, if there's any movie producers out there listening, I think somebody should consider doing the J. Lewis Mills story, because this is really something that you've been able to do that. And I don't think, you know, people can call it cocky, man, but I don't think you wouldn't have been able to do it if you didn't have confidence in yourself. So
yeah,
that's
yeah.
Really great.
You're absolutely right. You know, And I do agree with you, Senator. I really am not cocky, but that is, you know, a negative energy that I've heard. But you know, I'm a firm believer, and the one thing that I want people to take from me or to look at me and say is, You know, I have no problem with anybody saying if Jay Lewis can do it, I can do it.
Right.
You know, just say it, do it. But, you know, there are so many times that we let family members, or we let what we want to call friends, basically take us away from our dreams and take us away from what we believe in ourselves. At a very early age, I had to dismiss people in my family from the title that they hold. You know how you're supposed to have the utmost respect for a mother, a father, a sister, an uncle, an aunt. But if the person that is within that title, if they're not living up to that title, it's not up to you to say, well, you know, that's my mother, so I can't think this way, or that's my mother, I have to listen to her. Yeah, no, you really honestly don't. So, you know, there was a lot that went into me becoming the person, you know, that I am now. The person that I was before, I don't think I would have been strong enough to deal with, you know, going through the homelessness or listening to all the negativity from people. But I believe I was able to mature into a person that, you know, just really had no choice but to believe in me. And I mean, I still believe in me. And there were a couple of people that wanted to do a film about me. It's just wouldn't have been able, as crazy as it sounds, I wouldn't have been able to have had the amount of creative control that I would have wanted on my own story. So I just felt the best thing for me to do is write my own story. So that's what I'm actively doing now.
Well, that's great. And I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, I always felt before I became a parent, I have three children, and I thought, you know, you need to guide your children to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And then I became a parent and I realized that the real skill, the real thing that's important about being a parent is try to unlock the things that are already inside them and mm-hmm. make them the best person that they can be, rather than trying to make them into something, some vision that you have for them.
Yeah.
Allowing them to go on their own path, but being able to do things that help them enhance who they really are and bring out the things that are best in them, rather than trying to figure out what those things are and make it happen for them. And yes. It's hard sometimes because you see them about to fall on their face and you want to just naturally rush in and do something, but you say, no, this is a learning experience. This is what they have to do. You know, this is the path that they've chosen. This is the direction that they want to go in, and we have to enhance that.
I've got a lot of friends, basically a good amount of my friends from high school, at least, that their parents, or, you know, some of my actor friends are parents. I'm not a parent. I kind of do look forward to one day being a parent. But the one thing that I notice is it seems as though when parenthood comes about, some parents just forgot what it was like to be a kid. Some parents just forgot what it was like to be a teenager. And you might not agree with what a kid does. You might not agree with what a teenager does. But just remember back when you were a kid. Remember the things that you did. Remember the things that you did when you were a teenager. So I see a lot of parents trying to, you know, strong arm their kids, and you're not going to do this. Okay, well, how did that reach you when you were a kid? Like, how open to listening to an adult were you that was basically that strict, stern, it's my way or no way? So, you know, that's one of the things of parenthood. And again, I'm not a parent, and I've had parents tell me, I've heard parents say, spoken like somebody that doesn't have any kids. And, you know, that's a valid argument. I don't have any. But the one thing that I do know is when I do have children, my kid's not going to be my best friend, but I am going to understand where they're coming from in a lot of situations.
Well, it's important. And I say all the time, I use this line all the time. I say, the only reason that I never killed my teenage son when he was a teenager was that I would think, nobody killed me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would think back exactly. to the times and I would say, oh, my God, I did worse things than that. Oh, my exactly. God. You know, and people still love me and hug me. And, you know, and it's important. It's so important to remember that because, yes, I think a lot of us live through our children. And I had a son, for example, I have a son who was a good athlete. And I used to tell him, you're so lucky because I sucked at every sport when I was so I don't know what, you know, so I don't live, you know, vicariously through you. I don't know what to tell you to do. You know, I just sit there and enjoy the person you are. And that's, you know, and that's really the not only good for the kid, it's good for you too. And I live in an area, wealthy area in Washington, D.C., and, you know, we all we see a lot of parents push their kids to go to Ivy League schools and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I say to my wife, you know, we're focused on what we consider success instead of focused on them being happy, you know. And I yes. know people that graduated from Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and they're not any happier than people that, you know, went to community college or went to, yeah. or didn't even go to college. You know, we sometimes I think we focus on what we see as success rather than, you know, living yeah. a good, productive life that makes you happy.
And it makes the parent happy to say, oh, yes, my kid went to Princeton. Right. Oh, yeah, my right. kid went to Harvard. And the kid is right. like, dude, I just wanted to go to community college and call it exactly. a day, Mom.
And it's like so under so much pressure, they're yes. cracking up because, you know, it's really not who they were. And I think you're absolutely right about that. Trying to think back and remember what it was like to, you know, be a kid yourself is really important. So yes. let's talk for a moment. Now you're seems that you're writing your life story or you're writing your story and you're looking for acting jobs, but you also have a show called On the Level. What's that about?
Well, you know, it came about because I did an interview with the most awesomely cool Debbie Dashinger on for her show. And we met for lunch one day and, you know, I can talk. Everybody knows I have the gift of gab. So she told me, she's like, you know, you really need to do a talk show. And I was thinking about it just because, you know, I'm one of those people. The reason people ask me why I got into acting and, you know, it's the love of it. But, you know, one of the perks of my job is being able to be seen and heard by a lot of people. And I feel like I have a lot of opinions on society and our world that I would really like for people to hear. So another reason why I love doing my job as an actor is it puts me on a bigger platform to be able to speak to more people. And basically what On the Level is, it's there's just so much going on in our society today. There are so many different social issues. There are so many different political issues. There are so many different entertainment issues. But it's like if you know a situation is a certain way, you're not going to speak about it. You're not going to tell the full story. You're only going to give your side, or the other side is only going to give their side. So On the Level is a show, look, I just want to put everything on the level. I just want to put everything straight. My show two weeks ago, on my Facebook feed, I am constantly seeing people, Donald Trump is a racist. Donald Trump is a racist. You see people, Donald Trump is a white supremacist. You know, that just it just got to me to the point where I had to do a full hour-long show, and I was explaining, look, I think you're giving this man, if you want to say, you know, if you can understand where I'm going in this context, you are giving Donald Trump too much credit. He's not a racist. I grew up in Arizona. I know what a real racist is. And, you know, I told what I've, you know, in my opinion, a real racist is not going to acknowledge you. They are not going to shake your hand. They're not going to eat with you. They're not going to help you. They are you just don't exist as far as the real racist people that I dealt with in the state of Arizona. So to say that Donald Trump is a racist, if you want to say he's an elitist, I will jump on that train all day, every day. But to say that he's a racist, to say that he's a white supremacist, I think Donald Trump gives enough real reasons for people to either dislike him or question some of his judgments. Don't, in a sense, make something up. Don't be more like him. Don't stoop to that level. Just deal with what he's giving you. And I am I a Trump supporter? No. Did I vote for him? No. Am I American? Yes. Is he the president of the United States? Yes. Do I have to respect him as such? Yes. Now, well, I am absolutely not comparing Barack Obama to Donald Trump. I am not doing that. But some of the same people on my Facebook page that were screaming so much when Republicans had everything to say about Barack Obama now can't be quiet about Trump. And I'm like, you know, where's the hypocrisy here? I get it. You don't like the man, but you're doing the same thing that you didn't like the other side doing. But because the other side is on top now, now you think it's okay for you to do it. And the conversation is never going to start for two opposing sides to sit down and have a conversation. If you're like, well, you did it, so I can do it now. That's just how I feel.
Well, and you know what? I've got to tell you something. I think that you're so right about this. First of all, you know, let me tell you that the reason that you're starting your show is very much the same reason that I started my show. This is my job. My job as senator for the District of Columbia, where I don't have a vote in Congress, is to get the word out about it and to talk to people. And that's why we started it. And the show evolved into something where we wanted people like you that have different opinions to come on so that we could start a conversation. And I absolutely agree with you that once you label somebody, the conversation gets shut down. Yes. So when you put the label racist on somebody, that ends the conversation right there. It, you know, and we so do that. We're so separated by these labels that liberal, conservative, you know, whatever the labels are. And then it allows you to discount people right out of the chute. You don't need to sit there and talk to them and discuss with them and try to hear their point of view. And one thing that I remember that my dad told me when I was a kid was that you can never learn anything from somebody that agrees with you, because you already know what they know, right?
Yes.
You need to have people that disagree with you in order to learn and to grow. So I absolutely, I don't know if we share the same opinion about Donald Trump, but I know that your opinion is an important opinion, and it needs to be out there and people need to hear it, because I think we do that. We go, oh, he's a racist. That's it. I can tell you everything about him in one word, racist.
Yes.
And that doesn't explain anybody. And also I agree with you that regardless of how you feel about this man, I didn't vote for him either, but he is the president of the United States. And as president, you do have to have respect for that, and you do have to try to understand where he's coming from. So
I will say the same thing that I said when Barack Obama was in office and the Republicans were talking so bad. I was like, you know, do you all not understand that there are other countries around this world that are seeing the disconnect that is here in this country? If there was a better time to attack this country, it is right now. because we can't agree on anything.
Right.
But you all don't stop to think about that. You don't stop to think our number one enemies are watching the same news programs that you're getting on, defiling the man that is that has been. If you didn't vote for him, okay, I get it. But what you have to understand is now, in my opinion, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, and I'm not crazy either, but you are putting our national security at risk by all this disconnect and discord that is going on. And I don't agree with it. I don't get it. If you don't like him, fine, don't like him. But don't tear this country down just because you're trying to forward your agenda. I'm not with that.
Well, and you know what, that I've been preaching the same thing for a while, saying that it bothers me to have, I just came from seeing Hillary Clinton a couple of days ago in her book tour. And the thing that bothers me is this whole resist thing. You know, it's not about resisting. It's about finding solutions. And I don't know why we can't come to the table and sit down and, and talk about these things. Well, unfortunately, Jay Lewis, we've run out of time here, but you're a fascinating guest, and I hope you'll come back and we can talk more. Now that we know your story, we can talk more about your opinions, because I think that you have an interesting perspective, and I'd like to share that with our listeners. And I hope that you don't mind me being this presumptuous, but I think that in addition to finding a guest for my show, maybe I found a new friend, because
absolutely,
you certainly sound like the kind of guy that I would like to get to know. So, so thanks for being on the show. Is there a website or anything you want to put out there that people can go to find out about you, or you know, anything you want to add?
Sure. First, let me just say, as I said earlier, Senator Brown, I am completely honored just to having this conversation with you. And I do hope to have more either on air or off the air in-depth conversations with you. I as well would love to sit and have real conversation with you. As far as, you know, what anything that I have, you know, your listeners, I would love for them to venture over to bbsradio.com/onthelevel. Check out some of my archives that of past shows that I've done. My show comes on BBS Radio Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Station 2. It's a call-in show as well. You can look for me on social media. I invite and accept everyone. I answer emails, I answer messages. So you can find me on Facebook at J. Lewis Mills, Twitter at J. Lewis Mills, and my Instagram, I think that's J. Lewis Mills as well. But it was an absolute honor, Senator Brown. Thank you.
Well,
very
thank kind. You. And I want to formally announce that I'm applying for the job of president of your Washington, D.C. fan club. And I hope that we get to talk again soon. So thank you. And we're going to leave you tonight, America, with a song in honor of our guest by the super group. This will show you how old I am. Blind Faith, which was Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker and some other really great musicians. This is Can't Find My Way Home by Blind Faith, and we'll see you next week. Maria will be back, and thanks again, Jay Lewis. We appreciate
thank you, sir. Exploitation.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.